are listening to Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart. One seemingly never-ending debate about why we are the way we are comes down to the debate of nature versus nurture. Was our fate determined at birth, or were we raised to be the people we are today? But this debate ignores a much larger question of who we are. In the grand scheme of things, we're mammals, and the traits we share with other mammals say a lot about who we are and what we aren't. We've decided to take on this topic for this week's Please Explain with Liam Drew, a former neurobiologist and science writer, and the author of a new book entitled I, Mammal, The Story of What Makes Us Mammals. Liam Drew, welcome to Midday.
Hi, Jonathan. It's great to be with you.
And also to our audience, we invite you, our listeners, into the conversation. If you have a question about biology or mammals, give us a call at 212-433-9692. You can write us on our show page at wnyc.org/midday or on Facebook or Twitter, where our handle is at WNYCMidday. So, Liam, can you talk about why you wanted to write this book in the first place?
Right. So, yes, the book is an exploration of a rather simple fact, this fact that we humans are mammals. And I guess it has a two-part backstory. One was a sort of freak accident, and then the second was a common part of anyone's life story. So it began, I was playing soccer on the Chelsea Piers Sports Center, sticking out in the Hudson River, and I took a rather painful blow to the midriff, and I was struck by a soccer ball in a uniquely mammalian part of my anatomy.
I was going to say, Liam, it's a little lower than the midriff.
This is true, yes. And so I went home in much pain and was complaining about this, and I just sort of wanted to ask this question of why I would be so stupid as to have my essential reproductive organs dangling precariously below my abdomen.
Let's be specific. We are talking about the testicles and the scrotum.
Okay. Yes. And so I sort of went into this, went to the sort of the internet and then to the biology books and wrote essentially a natural history of the scrotum. And this is a trait that's only found in mammals. And so this sort of introduced me to the history of mammals and how they evolved and why they may have put their testicles on the outside. And it happened twice in mammalian evolution, and once in us placental mammals and once in marsupial mammals. And we know this because marsupials have their scrotum in front of their penis, where ours is surely correctly behind. So anyway, so I wrote this.
I love that, Liam. Surely correctly.
Right. No. So, you need to look. Yes, honestly, if you look at a picture of a kangaroo, you'll notice it all looks wrong. Anyway, so I wrote this sort of labor of love essay and sort of amused but serious look at this feature. And it's not just about keeping things cool. And then I went back to my day job as a neurobiologist and tried to get some magazine editor somewhere to publish it. Not everyone was interested in the scrotum, but eventually Slate published it. And once it was up on the Slate website, I was contacted by Bloomsbury, my publishers, saying they'd very much enjoyed it. And had I ever considered writing a book, they were looking for new science writers. And when this email arrived, I was sort of in the throes of new parenthood. And for me, this had just been the most profound experience. So for decades, I'd been sort of, you know, neurobiologists, and neurobiologists tend to be a rather sort of arrogant bunch who think, you know, everything that's important happens in your cranium. And suddenly I was just blown away by this primal biology of reproduction, and sort of watching my daughter grow in a womb, and she was born prematurely, and we spent 2 months with her in Roosevelt Hospital in Midtown West, and it was just the most profound experience. And I was sort of thinking about this week with Stephen Hawking dying, and lots of people were posting how, you know, Hawking kept saying, you know, you've got to look at the stars, and doing that for him just made him want to understand the structure of the universe. And I think really that 2 months was my sort of looking at the stars moment. I was just so focused on my daughter and willing her well and determined that she'd develop as she was in an incubator, as she should have done it in a uterus. And I was so inspired by it, and I just wanted to understand all of this. And so, and the things, so when Bloomsbury asked me if I was interested in writing a book, I realized that lots of my preoccupations, the uterus, the placenta that had followed her out. And then this, how milk had become this lifeline, and also just this basic sort of fundamental bond that I'd formed with her. All of these things were traits that had uniquely evolved in the mammalian lineage. And so in wanting to explore them, I just thought, well, maybe I could just look at all the traits that make us mammals, that underlie this very primal, animalistic, but mammalian side of our nature.
So Liam, well, when did mammals first appear on Earth?
So they appeared about 220 million years ago. And so the book is sort of, it's sort of a 100 million year history from, so it sort of begins with fish crawling out of the water and sort of trying to live on the land. And then you sort of have amphibians branch off one way, and then reptiles go one way, and mammalian ancestry goes another. And over this 100 million year stretch, from sort of 320 million years ago to 220 million years ago, all these traits, or the sort of the fundamentals of mammalian biology, emerged. And then from 220 million years onwards, you've sort of got mammals, these little small furry animals living in the shadows of dinosaurs, until 66 million years ago, when a meteor comes down and obliterates the life as we know it, and the dinosaurs die out except for the surviving birds. But then the mammals really flourish. And
Liam, you had a term, I don't have the book in front of me, but you had a term of art for what the mammals did once the dinosaurs were wiped out. They when the dinosaurs were around, mammals were just sort of, they were basically, from the grand scheme of things, kind of hidden. They kept a low profile. But once that meteor hit and that layer of meteor dust, for lack of a description, settles, they explode like gangbusters.
Yes, exactly. I think I said in the book, I sort of compared it to a bunch of sort of amateur musicians jamming on the theme of mammalianness whilst the dinosaurs were around. And then once the dinosaurs were gone, I think I said it was like the instruments were handed over to John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk, and just this, you know, this burst of creativity happened. And so when the dinosaurs were around, no mammal, no fossil of a mammal has ever been found bigger than, say, a badger or a small dog. And then suddenly, once the dinosaurs are gone, there's this explosion of creativity, and you see all these sort of mammalian orders that we know now sort of emerging over the next 10 million years, which in evolutionary time is sort of a snapshot.
So throughout the history of Earth, there were different phases of mammals. Talk about those phases.
Right. So, yes, it's sort of in prehistory. So like I said, you know, the 310 million years ago or so, reptiles, reptilian ancestry goes one way, mammalian ancestry goes another way. And so the first wave, they're called pelycosaurs, and the most famous of these is the Dimetrodon. And so this is often, infuriatingly to people that study mammals, sold as a sort of toy dinosaur. It's this large lizard, about 2 meters long, with a big sail on its back.
But that's actually, yes.
Right, yeah, we've all seen it, right, in the natural history gift shop. And and so that was sort of the top predator of the day. And so in those days, actually, sort of mammalian ancestry were the top predators. And then they're around for a while, and then they give rise to what are called therapsids, sort of these obscure Latin names. But what's important is that you sort of see these animals getting progressively more mammalian. And what's interesting is that they sort of take over from each other. So there's these sort of waves of increasingly mammalian-like animals taking over each other. And then after the therapsids, you have the cynodonts. And then after those, you have the true mammals evolving.
So who is this guy? I can't even, you'll know who I'm talking about because I know I'm going to butcher his last name. Carl Linnaeus?
Linnaeus, yes.
So what was his contribution to all of this? Particularly, and by all of this, I mean the term mammal.
Right. So Linnaeus, he was a pretty confident dude. And so sort of mid-18th century, he comes along and he says he's going to produce a catalogue of all living plants, animals, and minerals. He throws minerals in there as well. And so he starts off with this 11-page pamphlet, and then progressively through his life, he updates it and updates it. And importantly, in the in one edition, in the 1750s, he suddenly creates this new category of animals. And what he did, which was fundamental, he wasn't the first to do it, but he was the first to really establish it. He said, whales and dolphins are not fish, they're mammals. I mean, so he based it on the fact that they give birth to live young and that they nurse their young. And so he basically groups together about 200 odd species, most of them from Europe. He's up there in Sweden. And then he has to come up with a name for this new category of animals. And he gives no reason for it. He just says he will call them mammalia or mammals. And so he basically chose the mammary gland as this definitional trait of his new group of animals. And he offered no explanation. So historians have sort of dug around to try and work out why he might have done it. One theory is that he was really opposed to this habit of wet nursing, which was very popular at the time in Europe, and he thought mothers should breastfeed their own babies, and for good reason. So basically he's called us mammals, and this new category of animal was created.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so then enter Charles Darwin. What does he do, and is he influenced by Carl Linnaeus?
So I think Darwin benefited hugely from Linnaeus's work, because Linnaeus has basically taken all, if we just focus on animals, he takes all the animals and then he groups them according to sort of shared traits, and he catalogues all of them. And so what it does is sort of show that some animals are more alike than another, and his arrangement basically maps out all the animals according to their alikeness. So it's a great system. But Linnaeus essentially thinks that this is divine creation that's put animals in these categories. And Darwin comes along, obviously, and comes up with his theory of natural selection. And although he's indebted to these people, he's pretty unsentimental about it. And he basically says, true classification is genealogical. It's about shared descent, which bonds these animals into the groups. It's not some unknown plan of creation. And so since Darwin came up with that, sort of cemented that theory, we now look for the interrelationships of animal groups and mammal groups according to shared descent and evolution.
There's a comment you quote in this book. It's been said that if mammals have hair and milk, then a coconut is a mammal.
Yes. Yes, exactly. That's the sort of mess you can get in with Linnaean classification. You know, if you're going to say that groups are trait-based, then yes, a coconut could be a mammal. But the fact is, and then I sort of go on to discuss that actually I ended up writing the book and organizing it sort of along a Linnaeus-type framework, because I said each chapter was going to be about a certain trait that mammals have. And, you know, you basically have to accept that animals, any evolving system, does what it wants. So dolphins basically realize they didn't need hair to survive, and so dolphins barely have hair. Not that we have much either.
Depending.
It does depend, yes.
Go on, I'm sorry.
So it's basically that, you know, there's always these sort of types of caveats. Teeth are incredibly important for mammalian evolution, but some mammals don't have teeth. So, there's these little caveats there. But
Liam, let me ask you about this, because you write about the jaw, and how the jaw sets the mammal apart from other species.
Right, exactly. Now, it's funny. So basically, for a long time, mammals have been defined by having a very particular jaw joint. And so they have a single bone in their lower jaw, which forms a particular joint with a skull bone. And reptiles have three bones in their lower jaw, and it joins another skull bone. And this is particularly useful when you're looking at the fossil record, because jaws often fossilize. And so you can say when the first mammals came along. And I kind of, you know, I struggle with bones a bit, you know. It's like, okay, so I've got to write about the jaw joint. And then you discover that these reptilian lower jaws with three bones in them, two that were lost, they weren't lost, they got progressively smaller and smaller until they were incorporated in the middle ear of mammals. And so they got this wonderful second career as these vibrating bones, which give mammals their fantastic sense of hearing. So it was this incredible transformation that went on there.
So Liam, real quickly, we'll start this conversation, and then when we come back from the break, we'll continue it. But one mammal that's gotten a lot of scrutiny because it's so strange is the platypus. Why is the platypus classified as a mammal, and what does that tell us about our classification system in general?
Right. Well, this sort of goes back to coconuts maybe being mammals. So, you know, if you have that, and it really did test these strict definitions. So in about 1798, the first platypus is discovered by this Englishman colonizing Australia, and he sends his skin back to England. And then these full specimens come back, and it's furry, but it's obviously got a duck bill. That's just there to confuse us. I think the duck bill is sort of evidence that evolution has a sense of irony. But the fur is sort of saying this should be a mammal. But this guy, Everard Home, who examined the platypus, found no evidence of mammary glands, which were obviously Linnaeus 40 years earlier had said was the definitional trait of this category. So that was immediately a problem. And then when Home looked at the reproductive organs of the female platypus, he couldn't for the life of him work out how this animal reproduced. And it looked like it may actually lay eggs. And obviously at this point, it was sort of mammary glands and live birth were definitional traits of mammals. Right. And this started this fantastic back and forth that lasted actually 88 years.
Wow.
To determine, first, the lactation debate lasted about 30 years. And you have these fantastically eminent professors, naturalists, who had very strong opinions about this. And it wasn't until a British lieutenant was in Australia in the 1830s, and he sort of had this pet platypus who died suddenly. He wasn't very good at keeping pets. And he skinned her for some reason and saw that she was secreting milk. And that's what secured its status as a mammal, the fact that it lactated.
Aha. Uh-huh. So then at what point did scientists actually accept that mammals could lay eggs? Was it at the end of that 80-year
debate? Yes, basically. Yeah, so that sort of swung everything one way. So so suddenly, if it lactated, it must surely give rise to live young. It doesn't lay eggs. And so Richard Owen, who named dinosaurs, founded the London Natural History Museum, was convinced that these animals could not lay eggs. And people were sort of saying, oh, we think we found these egg fragments in their nests. He's like, nonsense, you know, that must be excretia. And it took another 50 years until this young Scotsman who was working at Cambridge University went to Australia. And he sounds like a horrible character. He sort of employed lots of local people, killed over 1,000 platypuses and their cousins' echidnas, until he finally shot one in the process of laying her eggs. And so that sort of secured this idea that, yes, mammals could lay.
Yeah, he sounds like a charming person. I'm Jonathan Capehart. I'm speaking with Liam Drew, author of I, Mammal, The Story of What Makes Us Mammals. This is Midday on WNYC. We'll be right back with Liam right after a break. And we are back on Midday on WNYC. I'm Jonathan Capehart, and I'm speaking with Liam Drew, author of I, Mammal, The Story of What Makes Us Mammals. So before the break, we were talking about the platypus, and I think we ran the course. Liam, I'm sorry, maybe I'm just single focused, but I want to come back to the situation, the body parts that led to this book, and that is the scrotum. And there's quite a bit in this book about testicles and the scrotum, and you say that in many ways it's a perilous part of the body. What theories have been developed on why mammals evolved the scrotum?
Right. I can't escape the scrotum, can I?
Neither can I.
It's entirely my own fault. Right. So basically, we all kind of intuitively know that the scrotum is a device that regulates the temperature of the testicles, and it keeps them a couple degrees cooler than our core temperature. And so in the 1920s, as Darwin's theories were sort of becoming more popular, you had a guy at the University of Chicago, Carl Moore, who put this into an evolutionary framework and said that basically it was advantageous to cool the testicles off and that this was going to make them function better. And this has intuitive sense, and it's still in a lot of textbooks. But when people thought seriously about this. It was difficult to explain how this would have happened. So whenever you talk about the evolution of a complex structure, you need to have sort of a series of intermediate steps. And so to get the testicles from their sort of ancestral position, where they still are an elephant, say, up by the kidneys into a scrotum, they have to sort of move down through the body and then outside of it to actually get the benefit of the cooling. So how could you explain these intermediate structures? And so people said that actually maybe they function better at a cooler temperature because they got exercised for a different reason. And the sort of most prominent theory other than cooling was developed independently by two chaps, one in Germany and a guy in the UK who was watching the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. And then the next day he read about it in the papers, and he read that when they did the urine samples for drug testing after this rowing event, there's actually fluid from the rowers' prostates in their urine. And he kind of thought, well, this is kind of interesting that this abdominal straining might sort of rearrange all the contents of the bits and bobs down below. And he proposed that maybe mammals, when they develop this new way of moving, this sort of galloping bounding motion, which generates waves of intra-abdominal pressure, actually maybe it was the waves of pressure which disrupted sperm formation in the abdomen, and that's why they got moved outside the body. And I think that can sort of better account for these intermediate forms. But it's an ongoing question. After I published the article in Slate, but before I wrote the book, someone came out and sort of published a paper that really correlated body temperature with scrotums and not scrotums. And that sort of swung, if that's not a pun, swung things back in favor of the temperature theory, perhaps. So it's an open question.
The cooling hypothesis, as you write. You write the quote that the scrotum has nothing to do with the origins of the testicles, which seems pretty counterintuitive.
Well, so all male mammals have testicles. Most of them keep them inside their bodies, and only mammals move them outside of the body. So the scrotum is purely the word for the sac that holds these structures, which are ubiquitous across vertebrates.
So then, since we're on it, let's talk about the sex organs of water mammals. How are they different from the ones of land mammals?
Right. So you do find that most aquatic mammals have gone back on the scrotum, so they've pulled everything back up inside, and that may suggest that they don't need to be cooled down. But then actually, when people very carefully looked at the blood flow in dolphins, it turns out that sort of cooled blood from the fins actually passes by the scrotums and maybe cools them down a bit, but of course he had ancestors that had scrotums. And one of the guy who proposed the galloping theory, one of his big arguments in favor of this was that there are certain walruses that are largely aquatic, but that they fight on land, and they have these sort of thrusting motions that may create these abdominal waves of pressure, and they're the only aquatic animals that still have a scrotum.
One more question on the private parts of mammals, and that is, are mammals the only animals that evolved to have a penis and a vagina?
The penis, no. Penises are quite popular. They're a useful device for getting what's needed from the male into the female. The vagina, strictly speaking, in anatomical terms, is a mammalian invention. Female mammals have separate plumbing for each of their needs. So they basically have, the vagina is a dedicated reproductive structure, and they have a urethra for urination, and they have a separate exit for the solid waste, whereas sort of birds and reptiles and platypuses, everything goes into one common exit.
So how did marsupials, like kangaroos, how did they evolve to get their pouch?
So the pouch So marsupials have a fascinatingly different mode of reproduction. And so they are born at incredibly early stages of development. If you sort of see a baby kangaroo, so a kangaroo is about the same size as a human being, and they give birth to a joey, which is about the size of your little finger. And it does this amazing journey up the mother's abdomen, finds a nipple, latches onto it, and doesn't let go for months. And so the teat, lactation, fuels a huge part of marsupial development. And the pouch basically is enclosing the youngsters whilst they undergo this milk-driven phase of their development. Although it should be noted that although marsupial, it comes from marsupium, the Latin for pouch, about half of marsupials don't have pouches. They just sort of cling onto the nipples about it. But that's what the pouch does.
So why did the pouch remain? It's just with kangaroos, it's just evolution just decided to just say, all right, kangaroos, this is it for you. This is it.
I guess it's enclosing the young. I mean, they're literally on the nipples for months. And so it's basically creating a womb-like space.
Uh-huh.
And there was these fantastic stories when the sort of the Spaniards and the Portuguese went off and discovered marsupials, both in South America and Australia. There was all sorts of these fantastic theories that that the young marsupials were born in the pouch. And there was even this idea caught on. So the mother, before she gives birth, sticks her head in her pouch and gives it a sort of lick, and which may help the youngsters get in there. And people started thinking that the female kangaroo may sneeze the fetuses into her pouch. So there was lots and lots of confusion. And it wasn't really resolved until sort of late 19th century, early 20th century, how marsupial birth all worked.
Another unique feature, Liam, to mammals is the placenta. What's so important about the placenta?
So yeah, the placenta is a fascinating organ. I remember being genuinely shocked when my children were born to see the size of this organ that followed them out. You know, you sort of think the placenta is going to be this small like structure, and it's sort of like a dinner plate of solid flesh. And so the thing about placentas, and when I first glanced at the placentas that followed my children out, I kind of looked at them as if they were these sort of benevolent maternal structures that had nourished my children. But when you actually learn about it, the developing mammal, placental mammal, dedicates a huge amount of its initial resources to making this sort of life raft. And then it essentially attacks the mother. Like, my view of pregnancy was completely turned on its head researching this book. And so it's basically a fetal structure which burrows into the uterine wall, and then it's basically designed to gather as much nutrients and sustenance for the fetus as is possible. And the mother can actually end up resisting this. And there's this whole theory of how the placenta is shaped by genes inherited from the father. So in 90% of mammalian species, and certainly the original mammals would have been like this, the fathers had nothing to do with their offspring. They sort of, mated and then left and went off looking for more females. But what they left behind was their genes. And so their genes could program the placenta to sort of ruthlessly try and take as much resources from the mother as possible for the father's young. And the maternal genes were actually saying, well, hang on a minute, let's not take too much from the mother, because the mother would program her genes to sort of increase her likeliness of breeding again and again. And so you sort of have this conflict between maternal and paternal genomes that plays out in the placenta.
In the little bit of time, that we have left, Liam, we got to talk about this other vital part of life for mammals, and one that's unique to them, and that's breast milk. Why did mammals evolve to consume breast milk as newborns?
Right. So again, this was this is one of those complex traits that needs sort of explaining. Because when you look at it today, it's this fantastically complex, nutritious solution, which the babies, which human babies survive on for months. And they instinctively know to go to the breast when they're born. It's an incredible sight to witness. And so one of the great challenges to Charles Darwin, actually, when he wrote Origin of Species, a guy called St. George Mivart said no baby could ever have survived by the accidental consumption of some scarcely nutritious fluid, something like that. And so this theory had to be built up. So what we know from the platypus, this is where the platypus is really vital. That fact, as we discussed, that it lactates but lays eggs. And that sort of says that early mammals, that's exactly how early mammals would have bred. And so the main theory of milk's origins is that mammals would have been incubating their eggs and keeping them warm as possible. And then basically some sweat glands on the abdomen that were sort of the incubation pouch would have increasingly secreted. I mean, this kind of makes milk a lot less appetizing than it might otherwise be. They're basically sweat glands that hypertrophied and started sweating onto the eggs. And this was important for keeping them moist. As mammals became increasingly warm-blooded, the eggs would have been more liable to dry out, so this fluid would have kept them moist. And also, as they got warmer, they'd have been more susceptible to invasions by microbes. And so factors in this sweat might have been antimicrobial. Actually, there was a story this week where people found this new antibiotic in platypus milk that they reckon could actually save us from superbugs. But anyway, that's an aside.
That's a whole aside. Liam, I found the beautiful paragraph in your book. It says, in rocks that sit directly above the layer of meteor dust marking the dinosaurs' extinction, there lies an orgy of mammalian creativity. If nature jams on individual riffs, it was as if some competent but staid amateur musicians handed over their instruments to John Coltrane and Thelonious Monk. Boom. The Age of Mammals began. Liam Drew, author of I, Mammal, The Story of What Makes Us Mammals, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.